We just finished up with the first round, two nights of the top 20, I think it was, candidates from the Democratic side duking it out to try to move forward in the process here. From your background, what are you looking for going into a debate that is styled that way, 10 people per night across two nights?
Yeah, it's a good question, because the classic things that you want to do in a debate are give a nice presentation of your message, tie in a little bit about your biography to kind of connect with and your voters and humanize yourself. And then you want to make some meaningful distinctions between yourself and the other candidates on stage. And, you know, the folks who overperformed in this debate did all three of those things. They talked about their history. They talked about issues relating to policy in reference to their own past. And they did it not just by creating distinctions with folks on the other side of the aisle, but by creating distinctions between themselves.
Whenever we have a field with as many candidates as we do right now from the Democratic side, it is hard to differentiate yourself at some point, and it seemed as though some candidates were doing a little bit better job at that than some others. Is that just kind of part of having a strong performance, or are there some other factors that could be factored into this in terms of the questions that were being, how questions are formed and targeted throughout that process where you're trying to hear from so many people?
Yeah, so candidates are, if they're trained well, they're entering into debates with those goals in mind. Get your message out, get your bio out, and create distinctions. And one of the primary ways that you create distinctions is by lodging an attack. And you know, you have to think very carefully about how you attack. The data show us that voters are kind of divided on this. On one hand, they don't like negative things in politics. They're worried about them being partisan and divisive. But on the other hand, negative attacks tend to not only be memorable, but they tend to distinguish you from other people, so that even if it has some negative effect in terms of your likability, it creates a, you know, positive net effect relative to the rest of the field. So it's a really tough dance. And part of the issue is, I think that a lot of folks will, and particularly the candidates who aren't quite trained as well, look at a debate as a quiz show. The moderator is going to ask a question. Their job is to answer the questions effectively. And what we know from looking at how, you know, voters and non-voters watch debates is that they're not watching so much for determining whether or not someone's policy positions align with their policy positions. They're looking for folks who can create differences in a meaningful way. And, you know, the points in the first round of debates that, you know, the folks who stood out, the folks who overperformed, in my opinion, that's Warren, Harris, Castro, Booker, Buttigieg, or Buttigieg, I should say. Those five actually had moments in the debate where it was quite clear that they were distinguishing themselves from another candidate. So Castro, for example, took Beto O'Rourke to task on immigration and whether or not it should be a criminal offense to cross the border. Mm-hmm. Cory Booker distinguished himself from the rest of the field in defending the Iran deal. Kamala Harris obviously had, I think, the kind of sterling moment of both debates in her attack on Joe Biden around civil rights. And Elizabeth Warren was fairly aggressive on questions of both relating to healthcare and relating to ways we'll restructure the economy. So the funny thing is, if you watch the debate and you write down who you think did well, and then if you look at the polling data after the fact, all the people who overperformed did so by talking about their own story, advancing their message. But beyond just doing that, they created some meaningful difference with someone else by lodging an attack.
So as we're moving forward from this, the field is going to get smaller in terms of who's on the debate. You're going to get everybody on one stage instead of trying to recall what happened over a two-night period. And in the information age that we live in now, that can feel like an eternity sometimes. So how do you take some of the things that you picked up on from the first round and project that to a little bit smaller field, but maybe a more intense discussion?
I mean, there are two there. If you're if you're playing armchair debate coach, as we all like to do, I think the two things that you'd project forward. First of all, there's a difference between the first debate and the second debate. So in the first debate, I think it was 14 answers or speeches or segments of talk until any candidate attacked Donald Trump. So what was interesting about the first debate is that it seemed like everyone had made a calculation. Hey, look, the country's divided. Most Democrats are not big fans of the president. And let's show that we're about ideas. And particularly that debate was kind of framed early on as a kind of debate about the future of the Democratic Party. And, you know, the audience responses to that debate were good. But the degree of difference between the candidates individually, not as high as in the second debate. So it ended up being a little bit tamer debate at the front end. Typically, that's the end of the debate that matters. And I think people took from the first debate and the media reaction from the first debate the message that there ought to be a little bit more aggressive prosecution of the case against Donald Trump. And so in that second debate, Trump was mentioned more frequently. He was mentioned earlier, et cetera. And so I think, you know, as the field narrows, I think candidates are going to get the message that one of the things that Democratic primary voters are looking for is someone to aggressively prosecute a case against the president. So I think that'll become a sharper focus of the rest of the debates. You know, in the first debate, the main question was, how do we make the economy work for everyone? It's like the first eight answers were around that basic theme. I think Democratic candidates will realize that it's not just a taken for granted that voters don't agree with the president, but in part they're assessing who they think has the best shot to, you know, beat the president. And therefore, I think the kind of attacks will escalate if people want to differentiate themselves on the basis of their ability to beat the president. The second big thing, I think, is that, you know, weirdly enough, when you coach someone for a debate, you want to coach them to have memorable moments. So the goal of coaching someone in a debate is not that they get the answers right. It's that you're usually planning for that one or two big moments that, if you're lucky, is going to be replayed in the media, viral clips or news stories, whatever. Because debates, the biggest effect that debates have is not that that many people change their minds as a result of the debate. The weird paradox is that most people who will watch a debate intently enough to make distinctions between the candidates are also politically informed enough to know who they're already aligned behind. Mm. So the biggest function a debate has is the narrative after the debate. And, you know, you could see as this played out, it's nice to do a story a little bit after the dust has settled a little bit, because the biggest story here, I think, is that Joe Biden looks vulnerable, and the candidates that I just mentioned as outperforming in the debates also have outperformed in terms of fundraising and name recognition and Twitter following and all that. So the post-debate narrative was Biden's kind of sleepy, Sanders not quite as sharp as we expect him to be normally, and really Harris, Warren, Castro, and Buttigieg came away and separated themselves from the field on the basis of those three things. That they said their message, they tied it to their bio, and they did it in a way that created a meaningful distinction between them and some other candidate.
Whenever you, it seemed like there was, you mentioned Booker earlier and those kind of viral moments. Unfortunately, I guess for him, one of his being the stare that he had while O'Rourke beat him to the speaking Spanish punch in the the debate. Whenever you have a lot of candidates vying for similar votes, we shouldn't be surprised that they're kind of wading into similar waters to try to attract those voters, should we?
I think that's right. I mean, the weirdest part, and it's like it's really kind of interesting political triangulation. In part, speaking Spanish is a way of reaching out directly to Latinx voters, that's for sure. But secondarily, that's an argument about your ability to beat the president, because, you know, primary voters will be evaluating your strength in the field, and they think that it is a significant asset to be able to court the votes of Spanish-speaking folk. And, you know, I think you're right. I think your assessment is dead on that Booker had planned to do it. Beto did it first and did it much more consistently. And, you know, body language is one of the funniest things that people coach and debate. There's a big difference between, in my experience, how Republicans coach it and Democrats coach it. Democrats are actually fairly invested in thinking about body language. There's a famous Democrat debate consultant that talks about the necessity of taking a power stance. And, you know, that body language matters to them. And weirdly enough, Republican voters, I think, or Republican debate consultants don't worry quite as much about it. The general thing that they coach their candidates to do is just not to look at the other person and to primarily speak directly to the audience or the moderator or the camera. And as a result, I think, you know, Booker was a good example of someone losing discipline a little bit, George Bush checking his watch. You can think of all kinds of great moments in the history of debate where the camera's on and people aren't being attentive to their body language. You know, obviously that's it was a great meme, and I don't know that it was entirely negative for Booker, because, you know, it gets a little extra coverage, and the reception of O'Rourke's kind of repeated turn to Spanish in the media was kind of ambivalent, in my opinion. People understood the logic of the move, but wondered if he didn't kind of press it one too many times. And of course, it opens you up to the tack that you're more interested in talking to Spanish-speaking voters than you are to talking to voters who speak English, which I'm not sure is an entirely fair attack, but is an easy attack for folks to make. So, yeah, it's interesting. Body language things become really interesting because so many times they can become the basis of not winning a debate, but a gaffe that makes you look like you're in a position of relative weakness.
As we move forward, it's hard to not think back to the 2016 election and some of the things that Donald Trump did in that election that seemed to buck the political trend and kind of the way that he spoke even to other candidates. And that kind of speaks to the rhetoric piece of this. So how do you think that is going to evolve as we move forward eventually from Democratic debates to general election debates with whoever the candidate is? Against kind of a known entity, I guess, in Donald Trump.
Yeah, I mean, the part of the huge advantage of the Trump 2016 campaign was that compared to someone who had an electoral record or electoral promises that had been or hadn't been fulfilled, there's a relatively narrow range to attack him on. Now, there was lots of attacks you could have made, you know, and some of them were prosecuted. The Clinton campaign said, you know, that you couldn't trust his temperament and he didn't know the issues. And the problem was that all those attacks kind of seemed to reaffirm a narrative he'd been arguing about for a while, which is essentially that establishment politicians were out of touch and they didn't quite know how to connect with real people. And, you know, he was in a really advantageous position to simply attack not only Clinton, but attack the political establishment and to create a fairly narrowly defined path that relied on the discipline of GOP voters and crossover voters from the kind of Rust Belt states especially. I think, you know, the next time around, it's going to be a lot more difficult for him. And a good Democratic candidate will make the case that, because it's weird, in a debate you're going to do two things. One, you're going to speak to people who agree with you. And the second thing you do is essentially try and demotivate the base of the other side. And, you know, there's a ripe field there for someone to say the GOP promised you deficit reduction, our deficits are exploding, the GOP promised you free trade, we're in the middle of a trade war, the GOP promised you that they'd fix, not only repeal the Affordable Care Act, but replace it with something else. And not only were they unable to directly repeal it absent the tax plan, but didn't create a replacement. The GOP promised you that it would create tax reform that benefited the middle class. But when you count up the costs of tariffs and difficulties in the economy, average American family is being set back, et cetera, et cetera. So, you know, Trump, I think this time, President Trump this time will not have the advantage of simply being on offense against the political establishment. He has to defend a record, and specifically a record that includes a bunch of real difficult things, both from people on the progressive side, but weirdly enough, from people on the conservative side too. So a candidate that is willing in a general election not only to lodge those points, but to have some affirmative vision of what they think America should look like, I think that's what in the first debate, making the economy work for everyone was, will, you know, be in a decent position to prosecute a fairly aggressive case. And, you know, there are a bunch of extrinsic factors that no one can control, like the state of the economy and what's going on in foreign policy. But, you know, I think the president has a lot more serious set of obstacles this time than he did in demonstrating the case for helping, you know, workers in industrial areas and bringing back jobs, and demonstrating the case for making the economy work for everyone, and in demonstrating the case that he'd adhere to principles that are meaningful to conservative voters outside the, you know, important ambit for them of the Supreme Court and gun control.